I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to Lungcast. So this back-to-school time of year has traditionally been marked by back-to-school clothing sales, school supply sales, and so on. This year, the back-to-school topics include vaccinations, masking or no masking, remote or in-person, and so on. But each year, this time is also marked by a need to assess the needs for patients with asthma. Today, I want to take a few minutes to discuss this topic with Cindy Trubisky, the National Senior Director of Asthma Programs here in the Health Promotions Division of the American Lung Association. Thank you for joining us today, Cindy.
Oh, thanks so much, Dr. Rizzo. Glad to be here.
Can you please tell us why we at the American Lung Association feel it's important to raise awareness of asthma at this particular time of year?
Oh, sure. It's a great question. So every year at this time, we focus on back to school and the needs of asthma management as top of mind for everybody. So parents, school health professionals, the kids themselves, and healthcare providers. We have lots of new schools and routines, asthma triggers, managing symptoms and medications. Everything's new and exciting, but it can also be concerning. We try to bring back the basics to make sure everyone in the asthma team is on the same page for good asthma care. Respiratory infections are common triggers for kids with asthma, meaning that if they get their respiratory viruses, they're at risk for experiencing asthma symptoms and make it more difficult to breathe. And fall allergies are also a concern during this time. So this year, especially, parents are concerned about sending their kids back to school due to the concern over getting COVID. Although, you know, kids with asthma are not more susceptible to contracting COVID, if they get it, they, like any other respiratory illness, they could have complications with breathing and their asthma.
Yeah, you probably touched on this a little bit, but more recently I've been hearing the term peak week. What does that term peak week mean related to asthma?
Thanks, Dr. Rizzo. The third week of September is typically nicknamed asthma peak week, or sometimes the September asthma epidemic. So during this time of the year, like clockwork, children experience more frequent asthma symptoms, increased asthma episodes, visits to the urgent care or asthma-related emergency room visits, hospitalizations, and doctor visits across the country. And the culprit is a combination of increased exposure to allergens, irritants, and viruses. So that means new routines, back-to-school stress and anxiety, exposure to viruses and new environmental allergens. It includes high levels of pollen, specifically ragweed, mold, plus cold and flu season starting up, along with COVID in our communities. The challenge, it can be significant and shows up every year during the September-October window. The fall season impacts many people with asthma and is a good opportunity for healthcare providers to prepare to review the asthma treatment plans and update them as necessary. So I want to mention a few of the most important things to cover during a back-to-school asthma visit. There are six things on the list. Assessing asthma symptoms over the last 4 weeks, identifying the risk factors for exacerbations, measuring your lung function, and documenting treatment steps and any changes that might be involved. Observing inhaler technique along with adherence and side effects, and discussing patient goals and attitudes with their treatment options to make sure it matches up with what they need.
That's very good, Cindy. So as a takeaway, what would be your key messages to the healthcare providers that are listening that really should be top of mind at this time of year for their school-age patients?
Patients and caregivers need to be prepared and to maintain their good asthma control as the top priority to avoid unnecessary peak week issues and throughout the school year. And we can do that through a number of pieces: assessment of asthma control and properly and realistically managing asthma. It's a team effort. That means the patient, the caregiver, the providers, and the schools all need to be involved. And communication and partnerships are key. So shared decision-making and honest conversations about asthma management goals, medication choices, proper medication use and adherence, and triggers. All that put together can really put together a formula for success. You can also ask open-ended questions such as, what are your goals for daily life? What would managing your asthma better look like for you personally?
Can you refer some resources to our listeners, as well as resources they may be able to share with their patients and their parents?
Yes, we definitely have a variety of educational materials, training resources, and tools that'll help bring awareness to all of these topics. And they can be found on our website at lung.org/asthma. And I just want to highlight a few. The first is for the healthcare professionals. We have a website hub that's called For Asthma Healthcare Professionals. Do you need help putting the national guidelines into practice? So here's where you're going to start. We have a series of webcasts from the December 2020 focused updates to the asthma management guidelines. So if you're looking for a refresh, this is a good starting point. And there's even a January Lungcast, episode 6 with Dr. Ann Dixon at the University of Vermont, that can give you a crash course. Number two, or second on the list, is the Written Asthma Action Plan. It's a best practice for creating a plan for anyone with asthma, no matter what their age, and can be used as a communication tool for medication, vaccination, and trigger management. So we have the Asthma Action Plan for home and school in both English and Spanish. And this form serves not just as a student's medical treatment plan, but when signed by the healthcare provider and parent, can also act as an authorization form, sometimes eliminating the need for schools to collect and track multiple forms. Our third up is to really help you assess asthma control status by using validated tools such as the asthma control test or others like we have on the American Lung Association website, My Asthma Control Assessment. It walks through your control status. The My Asthma Control Assessment is a 7-question online survey that's based on the validated tools with a downloadable summary as a guide to start the conversation about asthma treatment options and opportunities for improvement. And then finally, I wanted to share a really real resource as a teaching how to self-administer medications, whether that's quick relief medication or controller medication. There's two basic parts: assessing a child's readiness to self-carry and use their medication independently. So we have a tool for that, some information on how to do that, and having the patient demonstrate or teach back proper inhaler use, including a valved holding chamber or spacer, and or the use of nebulizers, which were not being utilized as often during the pandemic. So we want to do this at each visit to ensure that the patient is taking their medication correctly and it's reinforced. We have handouts and videos that help to reinforce that demonstration. And okay, finally, I want to share with you a few of those resources that parents and students and schools can all benefit from. Our Asthma Basics program, it's a free self-paced online learning module to teach participants to recognize and manage triggers, understand the value of the asthma action plan, and recognize and respond to breathing emergencies. It's ideal for everybody, including healthcare professionals, and the parents and caregivers and the general public. We also have our helpline, which you can talk to our experts for free on any lung health topic and get accurate information from licensed registered nurses, respiratory therapists, and tobacco treatment specialists. And then two final references, one for the parents. It's a back to school with asthma checklist. Here you can check off all those back to school items that are needed. And also a asthma toolkit that's for school professionals. So I think that's it for now. And that's a lot to take in. I appreciate that. We're ready to assist in a team approach here at the American Lung Association for everybody. So thanks so much for the opportunity to discuss this today.
Well, Cindy, you very well covered it comprehensively, but concisely. And I think there's a lot of good messages. It's hopefully going to make our patients with asthma have a little smoother time this year, despite everything else that's going on around them. So thank you again for the time.
Last December, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute released the first update to asthma management guidelines in 13 years. There were plenty of factors behind the deliberation, which guidelines authors said began with a needs assessment conducted 6 years prior. But maybe this was the most pressing factor. Our definitions of asthma and our capability in treating its subtypes have evolved. Take, for example, the biologic drug class, a line of unique interleukin-targeting inhibitor therapies that in recent years have shown significant clinical benefit for symptoms and biomarkers in the most acutely affected asthmatic patients, those with severe disease and or type 2 inflammation. Biologics wield an abundance of potential therapies in atopic, allergic, and inflammatory disease. But their limitations are also becoming well-defined in specific fields, such as asthma. There's plenty we know, and there's plenty left to learn. This month, we spoke with Dr. Mario Castro, Chief of Pulmonary Critical Care and Sleep Medicine, Vice Chair for Clinical and Translational Research, and Director of Rainbow Clinical and Translational Science Units, Frontiers at the University of Kansas School of Medicine. The longtime Lung Association advisor joined LungCast to discuss the individual agents that make up the asthma biologic drug class, their role in guideline-defined asthma management, and their promising future in inflammatory care. We hope you enjoy.
So Dr. Castro, thank you for joining me today. So over the years, the term asthma has been associated with different modifiers: childhood asthma, allergic asthma, atopic asthma, exercise-induced asthma, and asthma that people grow out of. Later, the terms mild, moderate, persistent, controlled, uncontrolled asthma became part of our vocabulary, and I believe mainly as a result of NHLBI and GINA guidelines. Most recently, severe asthma, and more importantly, type 2 inflammation, have become a key concept in the management of patients with asthma. As you know, NHLBI updated their asthma guidelines this past year, and we were fortunate to have one of your colleagues, Dr. Ann Dixon, on an earlier LungCast to discuss some of those updates in asthma management covered by that review. An area that was not covered during that review is this concept of T2 inflammation and the subsequent development and use of various biologic agents to treat what has been termed severe asthma. So as a starting point, I was hoping to get us all on the same page by you explaining your definition of severe asthma and describe the role of inflammation and the meaning of T2 and or non-T2 inflammation with regard to the patient with asthma.
Sure. Thank you, Al. So when we talk about patients with severe asthma, we use a combination of having an underlying diagnosis of asthma. We can talk about that definition, together with a patient that is either on high-dose therapy with inhaled corticosteroids with a long-acting controller and requires that treatment in order to maintain their control, or despite that, they're not achieving control. And as the guidelines usually refer to these patients being on the GINA guidelines, step 4 or 5 therapy, and then on the NAPP guidelines being on that severe persistent category. Now, we know these patients with severe asthma represent somewhere between 5 to 10% of the population of people with asthma. And what we've been able to advance our therapy for these patients is by really understanding the phenotype or characteristics that lead to their underlying disease. And we call that underlying disease their endotype. What is driving that disease process? And we have a number of different categories that we have proposed for kind of characterization or phenotypes of asthma. And one broad category would be T2 driven disease or non-T2 driven disease. And T2 inflammation includes that inflammation that is driven by T2 cells. These can be T helper cells that have differentiated to produce IL-4, 5, or 13, or they can also be the ILC2 cells or that can produce both IL-5 and 13. We know that these T2 signals, these T2 cytokines, are critical in terms of attracting inflammatory cells to the airway. In particular, for IL-5, that would be 13. For IL-5, that would be eosinophilic inflammation. And then for IL-13, we know that that is important in terms of causing inflammation in the airway, in particular, the creation of goblet cells, which produce mucus and also contribute to a phenotype and asthma. So this T2 phenotype is really help us advance targeted therapy for severe asthma. So we can now target those particular T2 cytokines and we can abrogate that inflammation and lead to improved control with biologic therapy.
The cytokines you mentioned and the inflammatory cascade, I believe along with this information, we've developed certain biomarkers that are being used clinically to help determine some next steps with therapy. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about those different biomarkers like IgE levels, blood eosinophils, and exhaled nitric oxide, I think are some of the prominent ones among them.
Sure. And those are the ones that we have access to clinically. So for IgE, we use that in order to characterize patients' allergic status. And so typically patients that have elevation in their T2 levels will have Ig levels that are 150 or greater. And this, you know, I consider that as a broad categorization. It's not specific to allergic asthma, or it doesn't predict response to biologic therapy. We typically will then, you know, to characterize allergic asthma further, we'll get specific IgE levels and figure out what patients are allergic to specifically, or we'll use allergy skin testing to identify that. The category of one of the biomarkers that we use the most often are blood eosinophils. And blood eosinophils have really helped us advance kind of our understanding of eosinophilic asthma, which is a subset of T2 inflammation. And eosinophilic asthma is defined by a blood eosinophil level of greater than 150. And again, this has been established in the GINA guidelines as well as the NAPP guidelines. And we know that blood eosinophils is a prognostic biomarker as well as a biomarker of predicting response to therapy. So what am I prognostic biomarker? Well, that means that patients that have elevation in their blood eosinophil levels are at increased risk of downstream events like exacerbations, reduction in lung function. And so for every increase in that blood eosinophil level, certainly once you get above 300, 400, and 500, those patients are at increased risk of having future exacerbations. And then we use it as a therapeutic biomarker to predict response to interventions that we can use, such as inhaled steroids or biologic therapy. We know patients with elevation blood eosinophils levels respond better to inhaled corticosteroids. But now with the biologic therapy that we have available, in particular anti-IL-5 therapy, we know if your blood eosinophil is greater than 150, you will respond to that biologic therapy. And the higher that level, the more likely you will respond to that anti-IL-5 therapy. Now, the last one you mentioned, which is exhaled nitric oxide, that's available in most specialist office, often in allergy offices or pulmonary offices that have it. And it's a simple measure of exhaled breath levels of nitric oxide. And I kind of think of it as a kind of a broad inflammatory marker, but it's specific to airway epithelium. And we know that in patients with severe asthma, that there is a subset of those that had elevation in their exhaled nitric oxide levels. We know that it can be affected by things like respiratory infections, kind of your smoking. All these can affect your exhaled nitric oxide level. And we call it fractional expired nitric oxide level in parts per billion, or FeNO, as we like to refer to it. We know that a FeNO level greater than 20 parts per billion identifies T2 disease. So those are really the three key ones that we can use clinically: Ig levels greater than 150, blood eosinophils greater than 150, and FeNO greater than 20 parts per billion, what helps us identify a patient with T2 inflammation. You could have one of those, or you could have all three elevated in a particular patient. On a research basis and in some specialized centers, we can measure sputum eosinophils. We typically will use a cutoff of greater than 2% eosinophils to identify that eosinophilic asthmatic patient. But clinically, we just don't have that available in most centers. So the majority of us rely on the blood eosinophils as a surrogate to reflect what's going on in the airway. It's not 100%. And that's kind of what I tell my colleagues is that, you know, you could have a blood eosinophil that is 100, but you just got exposed to steroids from your exacerbation just in the past week, and you could be dampening that eosinophilic asthma because of that systemic steroid that that you've taken recently. So it's not 100%, but it's a pretty good one that we can utilize in the management of disease.
Do you think those same biomarkers hold true for, I think you alluded to IL-5 cytokines, certainly can be more predictable of response with these markers. Do the same thing hold true with the IL-4, IL-13, and now more recently the TSLP or thymic stromal lymphoprotein?
Yeah, so what's interesting in each one of these categories, the eosinophilia helps us again identify a T2 bio. It's a T2 biomarker. I consider it kind of a broad T2 biomarker. And so elevations in blood eosinophils helps us identify those patients that potentially a biologic therapy against IL-4, like the IL-4 receptor blocker dupilumab, which blocks both IL-4 and IL-13. If you have an elevation in your blood eosinophils, you will then have a greater response to use of dupilumab. And that's certainly greater than 150 was shown in both the Quest study and the phase 2b study that was shown. And the higher that eosinophil level, similar to the anti-IL-5s, the more likely you're going to respond. We see even a greater response with blood eos greater than 500. Now, what is different with anti-IL-4 is that we can use FeNO also as a predictive biomarker to response to that therapy. So in the Quest study, we show that if you have a FeNO of 25 parts per billion or greater, you are more likely to respond to dupilumab in comparison to placebo. And so I use both in the clinic now. Sometimes I'll have a patient that really doesn't have much eosinophilia, but then I measure their FeNO and their FeNO is 30 or 40 parts per billion. I know that patient is more likely going to respond to that targeted therapy. Now with TSLP, we're still learning about that. I mean, it certainly, there's been some recent publications. It's not currently FDA approved. Tezepelumab is the monoclonal antibody that's been developed against TSLP. And this, the signal mechanism is very interesting because it's much more proximal in the airway epithelium. And it's what we refer to as an alarmin because it's released from the airway epithelium in response to either an allergen or an irritant or a virus or bacteria, some kind of trigger to the airway epithelium. And it's an alarmin. It alarms the airway epithelium. And this then triggers downstream events, which lead to activation of the T2 cytokines, including both IL-5, IL-13. And the recent publications from use of tezepelumab, again, it appears that the blood eosinophil is a good biomarker of response to anti-TSLP. Again, the higher those blood eos, the more likely patients' exacerbations were going to be dampened by tezepelumab. But what was also interesting by the recent Navigator study was that these patients that had lower eosinophil levels also responded less than one, blood eosinophils less than 150. So this has been one of the first biologics that we have potentially available in that low blood eosinophil group where there could be a response. So I'm really excited about it. If it does get approved by the FDA, this will be another tool in our armamentarium that we can use to treat these patients that have that lower blood eosinophil level. Interesting, the source study, which was done on steroid-dependent asthmatics, did not show that same response to tezepelumab. So we'll be interested to see how this is going to play out as if it becomes available.
Maybe before we discuss some of the more of the biologics more, what kind of advice could you give a primary care physician who has patients with asthma as far as clues that they should look for to maybe start to sort out who's the severe asthmatic, but more importantly, who should they refer on to an asthma specialist such as yourself? You know, there's some things that primary care doctor has limited time in the office to make these assessments. What would be your advice to them?
Sure. I measure control in all of my asthmatics. So I use the asthma control test. There are other instruments like the asthma control questionnaire that can be utilized. And I think those are very helpful. I also, when I speak with my primary care physicians, I said, if you have that available, that's great. If not, use the rules of two. The rules of two is basically if you're having greater than 2 days per week that you're having daytime symptoms or greater than two nights per month, that it indicates that your asthma is not quite controlled. So that is very helpful information. If you have, lung function testing, certainly utilize that in the initial evaluation of your patients, because you'll identify some patients that have, significant airflow obstruction that you want to include in your decision-making for treatment of that patient. And we do, in the national guidelines, do recommend that you repeat that every 1 to 2 years in your patients with persistent asthma. And then the third tool I use to assess patients, and I think are helpful to our primary care colleagues, is really just asking how many exacerbations that, asthma attacks have you had in the past year? And we know that, again, patients that have two or more exacerbations in the past year are at increased risk of having future events and are at risk. And therefore, that historical information, now that may be available in your office records if you've been following that patient. But sometimes, patients go to the urgent care and, it doesn't end up in your EMR. So it's always good just to ask, have you had any need to go to the emergency room, urgent care, or to some office and get steroids? And they'll recall often, oh yeah, I did go once or twice in the past year. And that will be useful information to assess control in that patient that you're seeing.
Very good. Great advice. Just like in, as far as inhalers, like asthma and COPD, we have multiple devices, multiple molecules, multiple combinations. And now we're starting to see the same opportunities with biologics. And I know you get asked this a lot, and I certainly get asked it a lot too. What can you kind of share some of your algorithm thoughts as to when you're seeing a patient, what type of biologic you think you're going to be putting them on based on what they presented with and maybe based on their history? And as you mentioned, I mean, some of these have been out over 10 years, some of them are much newer. So just your thoughts on how to sort through the different variety of biologics that are out there right now. And certainly we're not, as the ALA, and I know you're not endorsing any one product over another, but just giving information for clinicians to use.
Sure. Well, I consider them in three broad categories right now until we have more information on tezepelumab. The three broad categories are anti-IgE, anti-IL-5, and anti-IL-4 receptor. And so when I think about using anti-IgE, which would be omalizumab, which has now been approved almost for 20 years, and so we have a lot of experience with omalizumab, I'm thinking about that patient with underlying allergic asthma that has that classic allergen-driven, allergen-triggered disease. You know, they it may be seasonal, especially in children. It's approved for children 6 years of age and older. You know, very nice information showing that kids that go to the school in the fall that, you know, starts to encounter those viral triggers. If they have underlying allergic asthma, you use omalizumab, you kind of dampen those triggers during the fall and keep them under much better control so they don't have to require steroids. With omalizumab, keep in mind that it's also approved for urticaria and also recently approved for nasal polyposis. So these are some other comorbidities that I kind of keep in the back of my mind when deciding whether or not to use that as a biologic. Now, the anti-IL-5s, there are a lot more choices there. There's three of them, mepolizumab, brezolizumab, and benralizumab. I like to just say mepo, rez, and benra. It's a lot easier to say, not a tongue twister. And when I think about those biologics, I think about several factors. One is the level of blood eosinophil levels. I think about their underlying comorbidities, and I think about their age as well and what their preference is in terms of administration. So currently, mepolizumab is the only one approved down to age 6. And so if you're certainly using this in a child or older child or adolescent, that would be a consideration for using that anti-IL-5. Mepolizumab is also approved for a relatively rare disorder, EGPA, or eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, and also approved for hypereosinophilic syndrome. So these are two pretty rare ones that I should be seeing, or a specialist should be seeing at that point if you're making that diagnosis, but just be aware that that is a FDA approved for that indication. The other anti-IL-5 that we have available is benralizumab, and it's a little bit unique in that it blocks the IL-5 receptor. And when it does that, it actually causes the eosinophils to undergo apoptosis or cell death. And so the unique thing about Benra is that it can actually be given just one dose for every month for the first three shots. And then it can be given every 2 months. And sometimes based on that patient preference, like I have some patients in rural Missouri, rural Kansas, going to every 2 months is a good option for them so they don't have to travel as far. Now, rezolizumab is still one that I use, and it's the only one that has weight-based dosing. So it's given at 3 mg/kg in an IV infusion every 4 weeks. And sometimes I reserve that for my patients that are obese. I need to use a higher dose of an anti-IL-5, and I can give it with rezolizumab. The last category is that IL-4 receptor, and we only have one in that category, which is dupilumab. And dupilumab is not only indicated for asthma, but it's also now has an indication for atopic dermatitis and rhinosinusitis with nasal polyposis. So again, those comorbidities are important to keep in mind because you have that with your patient with asthma, then this would be a preferred agent to utilize to treat both conditions. With dupilumab, it's available in two doses, 200 milligrams and 300 milligrams. The 300 milligram dose I reserve primarily for those steroid-dependent asthmatics. That was the Venture study that showed that you were able to reduce steroids by 75% with 300 milligrams of dupilumab every 2 weeks. Majority of my asthma patients that I'm reaching for that as a biologic are T2-driven patients. So these are patients that have that underlying elevation in their FeNO, elevation in their blood EOs, or have that kind of that allergic-driven disease. Maybe you've tried other biologics and you've not achieved control. The guidelines basically give us the guidance that you should try a biologic for about 4 to 6 months. And if they're not responding, move on to another class. Because again, as we mentioned with blood EOs, it's not specific to any one of these biologic therapies. It's a broad Th2 marker. You're gonna have some subset of those are primarily eosinophilic driven, but you may also have others that are driven by the other T2 cytokines that we were talking about. So just kind of keep that in mind. It's not a specific biomarker. I wish I had a very specific one, but I don't have that yet. And so we use these the best we can in our clinical practice and reassessing that. I think the days where we left a patient on biologic for a year, 2 years, and kind of decide whether or not it worked, those are gone by the wayside now. We have a lot of options, and that's great for our patients because we can now give them a precision medicine approach, a targeted therapy approach to treatment of their disease. We can decide if they're responding or not. And if they're not responding, we have some other options for treatment.
When you have a patient that you've got under control with the biologic you ultimately decide on, is that something you foresee is going to be an indefinite therapy for them?
Yeah, so the first thing I say is I'm glad to have a response. And so what we know is that these biologic therapies are dependent upon ongoing treatment with those biologic therapies. So when we withdraw an anti-IL-5, usually within 12 to 16 weeks, their eosinophils start to come back. And so if you get a response, we maintain that treatment indefinitely. What we do is try to minimize your other medications. I said, if I can get you on a biologic therapy and just give you a little whiff of inhaled steroids and you're under control, that's my goal. So that you're really down to just, your one inhaler and your rescue inhaler and you're okay. So my goal always is to eliminate their systemic steroid exposure first, then minimize their inhaled steroids to the lowest dose possible. Also, just to decrease the amount of medications they're on. A lot of patients I'm seeing are on five different asthma therapies and they don't know which one's working. I don't know which one's working. So I try to systematically just step one down at a time, usually wait about four to eight weeks in between each one as I eliminate them. Because if anything goes south, you want to know, hey, this was really working for you, therefore we need to reintroduce it. But I've been amazed with these biologic therapies that I've been able to get some patients really down to just one therapy that respond well, and then their lung function improves, which has been quite impressive. I think in the past, we were just trying to aim from control, but now one of our goals, as I mentioned, is really to improve lung function and to get it normal. And that's possible now with our biologic therapy.
Well, that kind of feeds into one of my last questions here, what does the future of asthma therapy hold? And do we actually have the hope of finding agents that are going to modify the disease process as we go forward? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's an exciting time for us. I mean, I talk about this to my residents and I said, this field's pretty exciting. We have some good drugs now. So I think that what we're studying it now, whether or not they're truly disease modifying, none of these therapies have that indication approved by the FDA. But we might have some candidates. These biologic therapies, as I mentioned, they're achieving control, they're improving lung function, and we think that they might have a chance of disease modification. Now, the real question is, what do we mean by disease modification? Well, I'm looking towards improving lung function and normalizing patients' disease to the point that they do not have progressive disability from it. We know that, when you think about the patient with rheumatoid arthritis that has disabling arthritis, with a disease modifier, our goal there is to restore their function, restore their ability. And that's my goal. My goal is not to take away, cure the disease. I think that's an unrealistic expectation at this point with the current therapies that we have available. But if I can modify that disease to the point that their lung function is preserved, long-term, preserve that lung function so they don't ever reach the point of disability from reduced lung function, then that to me is a disease modifier. And so we're looking at that right now with studies doing CT of the chest, doing quantitative CT of the airways, looking at other ways to measure that either by biopsy with bronchoscopy to demonstrate that there's been reversal of that remodeling process. But those are all up in the air right now. We don't have that answer yet. My suspicion is that we're pretty close to there. And the other thing that I'm sometimes asked about disease modification is, well, what about if we introduce this very early on, you know, in kids? And could we change that progression that we sometimes see in children into adulthood, into the development of chronic obstructive lung disease? And I think that's another target that we need to aim for. And I'm quite excited about the possibilities there, because as we learn about these biologics and we're able to bring them down and safely and you know, in a well-studied pediatric population, I think we're going to get there. We're going to get there to the point that we understand who that child is that's at risk of progressive disease, and we could treat that child and potentially reverse that decline that happens over time into adulthood.
Very good. My last question, a little bit off script, but I couldn't get a whole lung cast in without mentioning COVID at least once. I know there's been some discussion over the past year and a half or so is what really is the interplay of an asthmatic and COVID disease? Do they have a higher risk? Do they get more complications? Is there in some way protective because of the ACE2 receptors? And I've heard different experts on different sides of the aisle on that. What do you feel right now based on your read of the literature?
Yeah, the latest data from the CDC in terms of looking at asthma versus non-asthma suggests that there is no increased risk to our asthma patients. Certainly when our asthma patients do acquire COVID, often they will have a reduced reserve and therefore need to be treated aggressively because of that. But I think it's, you know, I want to vaccinate 100% of our population. So, you know, I think if you have underlying asthma and you you need to get the vaccine as well, the COVID vaccine as well, because we know that the vaccines all, you know, all the approved ones in the U.S. in terms of the Pfizer and the Moderna and Johnson & Johnson all prevent serious disease. And that's exactly what we're trying to prevent in our asthmatic population. And I've had a lot of my asthma patients now that I've seen in clinic that have gone through an episode of COVID. And I can tell you from our own personal experiences, the ones that got the vaccine have a very mild disease. I just had several patients this past week. You know, they had a mild cold, or they lost their sense of taste or smell, and they had a COVID test and it was positive, but it never went down into their chest, and they didn't experience an exacerbation. So I truly believe that the vaccine is effective in my patients with asthma, and certainly encourage that. And I think you mentioned about the ACE2 receptor. At this point, you know, we've tested that here. We had a small study that we did with losartan. And so far, the inhibitors of the ACE2 receptor have not been shown to be effective in this patient population. We're still studying whether or not inhaled steroids have a role. In fact, the ACTIV-6 trial is studying inhaled fluticasone. So we don't know yet. I would say clinically, I tend to use inhaled steroids in my patients that have been impacted in terms of their small airways. I tend to use inhaled steroids in that patient population because I know that COVID impacts their small airways. And again, anecdotally, because we don't have great evidence behind it yet, I think that it does help in terms of their recovery process. But more to come there.
Absolutely. With COVID, there's always more to come.
That's right.
But I think but this was a good note to end on. I think your emphasis of the importance of vaccination in everybody, especially those with underlying lung disease, just reiterates what the American Lung Association has been telling people. So again, thank you for taking the time today. And this has been very informative and helpful to sort out what can be a complicated issue with these different biologics.
Well, thanks for for doing this, Alan, and thank you for your support crew.
Thank you again to Dr. Castro for guiding us through the myriad of emerging asthma biologic options. It'll be interesting to see how these agents continue to redefine our treatment opportunities. If you enjoyed this interview on asthma biologics, be sure to check out previous Lungcast episodes, including our discussion on the 2020 NHLBI asthma guideline updates with author Dr. Ann Dixon. For additional news and insights into respiratory health, be sure to visit us at hcplive.com and lung.org. Until next month, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. So just take it one breath at a time.